This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to hear the story of an infamous leper colony, which my guest John Taman describes as a long, deadly, and misguided experiment in medical segregation. It was located on a remote and inaccessible peninsula on the Hawaiian island of Molokai. For 103 years, beginning in 1866, the Hawaiian government forced people who were diagnosed with leprosy to live there. In his new book, The Colony, John Taman tells the story of this colony and considers what it tells us about public health. He points out that at the time of the colony, leprosy was believed to always be highly contagious, which we now know is not true. In part to destigmatize the disease, it is now referred to as Hansen's disease. The Hawaiian king signed into law an act to prevent the spread of leprosy, which criminalized the disease. What did the law say?
The law gave the Hawaiian government the right to arrest, imprison, and exile anybody they thought had the disease.
Is this a precedent-making law? Are there other laws that you know of that actually criminalized having a disease?
No, the law wasn't unique. Other countries had done somewhat similar things. But the king arrived at this idea primarily on the counsel of his American and European advisors. And they were reacting with some amount of panic to what they thought was an impending epidemic of leprosy.
Why did they think that an epidemic was imminent?
Well, the government was a little sensitive to epidemics of any sort because they had suffered through a series of them that had essentially halved the population in the islands from the time of first contact. It was estimated that about 350,000 Hawaiians lived there before the first white settlers came and the missionaries. And by the time they began to see an increased number of leprosy patients, that population had fallen to 150,000. And so, in part because the king was terribly concerned that the remainder of his people were going to be wiped out, he listened to his advisors, and the advisors said, the only way we can do this is to round up everybody who has the disease, put them in this island prison, and let the disease die itself out.
Now, you think that this exile was based on several misunderstandings of leprosy. What were the misunderstandings?
Well, at the time that they passed the law, they knew very little about the disease. And the law remained in effect not only through the Hawaiian government, but after America annexed the islands, and indeed after it became a state. And some of those misconceptions about the disease itself remained in place. Probably the biggest one was that leprosy was rampantly contagious. In fact, it's a very, very difficult disease to catch, and 95% of the population has a natural immunity. The other thing is that everybody they sent away, they assumed was infectious. And in fact, again, there are different degrees of leprosy. And as it turned out, of the more than 8,000 people they sent away to this island prison to die, more than half of them probably didn't have to be there. They were either misdiagnosed or they had the disease in a form that wasn't contagious.
Would you describe the disease that's now called Hansen's disease? During most of the historical period you're writing about, it was called leprosy. But would you describe the different forms of the disease and the different stages of it?
Sure. It's a chronic infectious disease that's caused by a germ. And typically what happens is that you inhale that germ like you would a common cold or tuberculosis. And then once, if you're susceptible to the disease and once it takes hold, it attacks the skin and the nerves. Now, the germ, the bacteria itself, reproduces best at cooler temperatures, and so it tends to move to the far regions of the body, the fingers and hands and the nose and the eyelids and the cheeks. And when it begins to multiply rapidly, it can cause disfigurement. Of course, in the 1940s, they did create a cure, and it's a multi-drug therapy that arrests the disease within a day of your taking it, and it stops any further disfigurement. Nonetheless, the disease is still relatively common in the United States. It's more prevalent than measles right now, and there's about 7,000 people who either have or have had the disease in the U.S.
The old stereotype of leprosy is that your fingers fall off and your toes and, you know, your earlobes, and how much truth is there to that?
Not very. What happens is that you lose the sensitivity, you lose what doctors call the gift of pain in your fingers and toes. And so where you and I might touch a hot plate or a sharp piece of glass and immediately feel the danger of that and yank our hands away, people with the disease aren't able to react that way, and so they are continually traumatizing their fingers and toes. I write in the book that on average, a typical person injures themselves 4,000 times in their lifetime, and most of that is everything from paper cuts to small burns and whatnot. Well, with somebody who doesn't have the feeling in their hands and feet, that number doubles or triples, and it's the constant trauma, the constant damage that they're doing to their fingers and toes that causes the blunting. So the myth that they're dropping fingers and toes and arms and legs in the street is just that. It's a myth.
Was there any way of empirically diagnosing the disease?
For many years, no. Certainly for the first 50 years or so, they had no clear way of determining whether you had it. Leprosy is caused by a particular bacteria, and it's relatively straightforward. It attacks the skin and nerves, and if it's left untreated, it can cause partial paralysis and insensitivity and blindness and some disfigurement. There's a cure now, of course, but until the early 1920s, they really had no bacteriological method of determining if you had the disease. When they finally did find one, they allowed people to be re-diagnosed, and of the first 11 people that they re-diagnosed, all 11 turned out not to have the disease. Many of them had been in exile for 20 years already.
Would you describe the peninsula that was chosen for the leper colony?
Sure. Robert Louis Stevenson called it a prison fortified by nature, and that's very much what it was. Molokai is the island between the islands of Maui and Oahu, and it's a relatively small, very underpopulated island. The northern side of that island boasts the highest sea cliffs in the world, these 3,000-foot green walls that sort of leap up from the sea. And about midway along the coast, there is a little triangle of flat land that emerges, about 2 miles by 2 miles. And it was relatively barren, and it had only a few residents on it. And so one of the original members of the Board of Health, who knew the island from his time as a traveling doctor in the islands, suggested that this would be an ideal place to send away these people. It's impossible to land on it because the seaside borders of the island are ringed by lava rock, and there's no natural landing or natural beach. And so the only way in is down this giant cliff or to try and pilot a little whaleboat to an edge of the peninsula and make your way in that way. It was very treacherous, and many people died.
So you're pretty well guaranteed of being kept very remote from the rest of the world.
It was. It was like the government intentionally shipwrecked these people.
So what happened to you if you were diagnosed with leprosy? What could you expect after that?
Well, nothing good, quite frankly. The government sent out tax collectors, sheriffs, other sorts of government agents, and in a few cases doctors, to comb the islands and identify anyone they suspected of having the disease. There was a master list that was kept. And based on that list, they decided whether you were a candidate to be exiled or not. And so essentially, these were businessmen, parents, and children who were pulled from their homes and from their offices and classrooms even. And they were marched down to the waterfront, locked into cattle stalls on livestock supply ships, and then sailed across the channel and left to die on this prison.
Okay, so the people who are quarantined to this peninsula, they're living in a place that is incredibly remote and hard to get to. They're not farmers or anything. I mean, what do they eat?
Well, the government actually thought they were going to be farmers. They thought the colony would be self-sufficient. And so on the first day when the first 12 people were dumped on shore and they straggled to shore, sort of soaked through with seawater and damp and blinking with shock, the resident overseer that the government had hired to literally just sort of be a sort of prison guard handed them a shovel or a hoe and a blanket. And then he marched them across to this abandoned village and told them to start making it their home. And they were expected to farm enough and raise enough crops to feed themselves. And what the government had neglected to realize was not only were these people not in the best shape to be effective farmers, many of them were weak and already ill, but the moment they did start getting together some crops and managing to get enough to sustain themselves, another boatload of people would show up, and immediately things fell into shortage. And so literally for the first decade or two, people were starving. There was constant daily shortages that were met with riots and rebellions and threats of murdering the resident superintendent, and it was an awful situation.
So what was the society like that developed in this colony of exiled sick people?
Well, in the early days, it was something like something from Lord of the Flies, where the strongest and most brutal held sway. And there were murders and riots and moonshiners and rape and prostitution. But within 5 or 6 or 7 years, the population grew to the point where there were more and more people who realized that if we are going to be a community, we have to make that community ourselves. They were civilizers, to use the phrase. And so they put in place a rough form of government. They had a sort of legislature for themselves, and they created a small police force to try and keep the people who didn't want to be lawful in place. And they began to sort of split into different factions that some farmed, some fished, some tried to build shelter for the others. The people who were educated could read and send letters off or in time try and file lawsuits to get themselves out. By the 1900s, it was almost like a typical small American town that just happened to be filled with people who either had the disease or the government thought they had the disease.
Did people marry and have children within the colony? And are there people who grew up as the children of the people who were exiled there who never knew any other life?
There were marriages and childbirths in the peninsula, and at various times the government would take the newborn away from the family at 1 year old and send them up the cliff and then place them in a hospital on what's known as Topside Molokai, which is the remainder of the island of Molokai. And then they were placed in foster homes or in orphanages. They later found out one of the genetic quirks that enables you to catch the disease follows along familial lines. So in some families, it is much easier to catch the disease. And in fact, some of the children who either were born there or had relatives there also came down with the disease. And so some have spent almost their entire life in exile.
You know, I think some people would assume that a place that was a colony for people who were then diagnosed with leprosy would be a place in which terribly disfigured people, people who look quite grotesque, were walking around. I think when people think of leprosy, they think of the worst images that they've ever seen. So what percent do you think of people who were sentenced to live on this peninsula were really hideously disfigured?
Much smaller than you would imagine. If you walked around the community, more than half of the people would look no different than a normal, healthy person. Leprosy doesn't manifest itself as disfigurement in every case, and so you had not only the people who never had the disease, but they were in exile anyway, but you had the ones that had the disease in a mild form, who were not contagious and didn't come into any of the disfigurement. Nonetheless, it's interesting, is that some of the most disfigured patients took advantage of their appearance to terrorize not only the current residents, but any newcomer. Often the boats that would spill the patients to shore would arrive at Kalapapa in the dark, either late in the evening or very early in the morning. And the more disfigured patients took advantage of that fact and would gather on shore with torches and stand in the darkness, cackling as the boats were heading towards shore, and screaming, "In this place there is no law." And as such, they managed to cow anybody who came and immediately would rob them or take their belongings.
My guest is John Taman. His new book, The Colony, is about a leprosy colony on a remote and inaccessible peninsula on the Hawaiian island of Molokai. For 103 years, beginning in 1868, Hawaiians diagnosed with the disease were forced to live there. Now, several missionaries were sent to the colony. Was this considered a very difficult assignment for the missionaries?
It was. I mean, at the time, what they knew about the disease implied that anybody who went to serve there was accepting a death sentence, that they were martyring themselves. That didn't necessarily have to be the case, but the most famous missionary is a man named Father Damien, a Catholic priest. The Catholic mission in the islands decided that there were 200 or so Catholics, and they needed the presence of a priest to take confession and to see to their needs. And Damien volunteered to go. And so at age 33, he entered the community, and he was the real first full-time priest to stay.
He ended up getting leprosy himself.
He did. He happened to be part of the 5% that lacked a natural immunity, and he freely intermingled with obviously infectious cases and passed his pipe around and ate from a communal bowl. He did so in part because he felt to do otherwise wouldn't allow him to be a priest. They had this thing. It was interesting in reporting the book. I saw it from the very early documents, not only in letters from the exiles themselves, but in the doctor's reports, and I later experienced it myself. They subjected visitors, newcomers, to something that might be called a handshake test. And when you entered the colony for the first time, people would come up and offer their hands. And depending upon how you reacted, that determined how they were going to treat you during your stay. If you shied away or if you pulled on your gloves, as many people did, you were treated with disdain and a tourist and essentially ignored. But if you did put out your hand and shake it and knew enough either to know that this was not a danger or that you were willing to accept that danger in order to do good, then they embraced you and welcomed you into the community. Damien, of course, sort of did his own version of that and immediately became a full member of the community. When he finally did catch the disease, he of course, began to describe himself as "we lepers" in his sermons, and that became really part of his legacy.
I'd like to ask you before we go any further about the word that we're both using, which is leprosy. The disease is usually referred to now as Hansen's disease, named after the person who discovered the cause of it. Is it considered inappropriate now to use the word leprosy? I think we're both, I know you use it in your book because you're using the time-appropriate language. And I'm using it because you're using it, I guess. So I'll just blame it on you. are we
well,
inadvertently offending anybody by using that word? I mean, is it considered wrong to use the word now?
It should be used with caution. As you mentioned, leprosy is now known in part by an alternate name, and that's Hansen's disease. It's named for the doctor who discovered the germ that causes the disease. But the word leper itself is loaded with so much power, it's become something like a racial epithet. And many victims of the disease feel that way. They're offended each time they hear it. It's an easy reaction to understand. Here are a group of people that simply had the misfortune to catch a germ. And for the rest of their lives, they're known foremost as lepers, the most powerful metaphor for otherness there is. And so when I use it in the colony, I make sure to use it either in its direct historical context or within a direct quotation. And in fact, the usage of the word begins to disappear as societal attitudes change. And so by the 1930s and 1940s, it appears not at all. And toward the end of the book, the people I write about are referred to exclusively as residents of the community of Kalapapa rather than lepers in a leper colony.
Who lives there now?
27 residents remain there, and their people in there, the average age is 72. They've been there most of their lives, 50, 60, 70 years. And they were sent away as children, and they're there by choice, in part because it is so magnificently beautiful. It's a quiet, lovely little town. Their friends are around them, and over the years, they've managed to make a loving community out of what had been some of the most harrowing circumstances imaginable. It's impossible to meet and talk with these people and not be overwhelmed by their strength and the power of their faith.
Now, you've written about a whole colony of people who were quarantined, and you've written this at a time when we're hearing about the possibility of quarantine in America if there is a bird flu, if there is a terrorist attack with smallpox. What are some of the lessons that the quarantined community you wrote about have for us today?
Well, the main lesson is that you can't let public hysteria drive policy. And that's what led to the creation of this colony, and it's what led to 8,000 people having their lives destroyed when most of it was needless. At the time I started the book, of course, I didn't really have any idea that there would be a current relevance to it when it came out specific to avian flu. As I discovered, one of the first instances of instruction for quarantine and isolation occurs in the Old Testament, where they give details on how to isolate lepers. Now, one of the terrible ironies is that in the Bible, the people who were described as lepers actually don't have the disease leprosy. And so, unfortunately, time and again you see governments reacting the same way when they're faced with an infectious or scary disease. It happened recently with SARS. It happened in the early 1980s during the first days of the AIDS crisis, when on a government level there was discussion of exiling everybody they thought had AIDS to the colony and turning it into a national AIDS colony.
Well, John Taman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
John Taman is the author of the new book, The Colony.